Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Shot at Love by T. B. Markinson, narrated by Gabrielle Baker. Chapter 1. The small red Vauxhall Corsa rental sputtered along the narrow and curvy country lane, winding its way through rolling green pastures. How were they still so green this time of year? The leaves, or what was left of them, were vibrant red, orange and gold. Josie Adams' phone, attached to her personal vent clip she always travelled with, a necessity for the always-on-the-move woman, rang. Her mum's number appeared. Josie sighed, but didn't answer. Not just because she had to crank the wheel for another hairpin turn while downshifting, but she still wasn't ready to talk. Not on the phone. Josie needed to speak to her mum face to face, after a hug. That had been her first priority after the October surprise that ended her life as she knew it. And there were still a handful of days left in the month. She yanked on the wheel again, muttering a string of curse words under her breath. If Josie hadn't been driving, she might have been able to enjoy the scenery and experience whatever kumbaya feelings people experienced when reconnecting with nature as a way of dealing with the disappointment that was called her life. No. Josie wrapped her fingers tighter around the steering wheel, her knuckles turning a sickening bloodless hue. Disappointment wasn't strong enough. Utter devastation. Complete ruination. Shaking her head, Josie was infuriated with herself for not having the right words to describe the feeling, which, given the situation, was a sick sort of irony. The last thing Nora had said to Josie was, "You're supposed to be a whiz when it comes to writing speeches. You failed me and the country." Screw the beautiful scenery. It wasn't going to save Josie from her dark thoughts, growing exponentially darker with each passing second. Besides, she was grateful to be behind the wheel. Josie was a terrible passenger for two reasons. First, she liked to be in control. Second, and perhaps more importantly at the moment, Josie suffered from motion sickness, and on these types of roads, she'd be hanging her head out the window to combat the need to puke. After yet another sharp bend in the road, Josie had to quickly swerve back onto the other side of the street to avoid getting creamed by a sleek BMW heading in the other direction, the horn blaring, the driver shaking a fist. Josie sensed all the sheep in the field turning their puffy heads to condemn her lack of driving skills. She downshifted and punched the gas to give the vehicle more power to crest a hill. "Britain ruled the world for centuries but never mastered driving on the right-hand side of the road," Josie muttered to herself as she eased the car back into the middle of the lane, since the two-way street was more suitable for one. Each time she had to move to the left, she feared destroying the paint job by scratching it either on a rock wall or overhanging shrubs. She'd checked out of the London Hotel early after getting a fitful night of sleep. Her last-minute flight from Boston the previous day had been delayed 4 hours and then circled Gatwick Airport for another 45 minutes before landing midday, instead of at 8 in the morning. After getting through immigration and making her way to the city, Josie had done her best to stay awake until 7 at night to help jumpstart her system to adjust to Greenwich Mean Time, but she'd only lasted until 5 in the evening before crawling into bed and covering herself with the bedspread to have a good old-fashioned cry that didn't make her feel better. The surrounding fields were dotted with white, which Josie assumed were sheep. Did they always stay exposed to the elements, or did the creatures have some type of enclosure for nasty days? Her mum had been born and raised in the area, so Josie thought she should know this answer. But if she did, the knowledge was buried deep inside or completely forgotten. At least there wasn't snow in the fields, unlike Pennsylvania, the last place she'd been on the presidential campaign trail. As Josie's eyes scanned the scenery, a momentary peacefulness she hadn't felt in months started to nibble at the tension. Jesus! She swerved out of the way of an expensive-looking car she couldn't name, let alone dream of affording. What are all these rich Cotswold bastards doing on the road so early on a Monday morning? Didn't they know Josie's life had crashed and burned, and the possibility of her taking out the next asswipe in a fancy car just out of spite was high? Josie had never been the violent type, but... Since Josie was alone in the car, no one responded to her outburst. Probably for the best. Americans weren't high on the respectability list worldwide once again, especially not one who was grumbling while driving in the middle of the road, acting like a typical American who wanted things to go her way. It was probably time to stop for breakfast. Josie needed to eat on a regular basis, or she was a nightmare to be around, according to everyone who had attempted to live with her. The list included two exes and numerous co-workers who had bunked with her in hotels all over America on numerous campaign trails. Her destination this bright October morning was Upper Chewford, one of the quaint villages in the Cotswolds. The Cotswolds, in south-central England, covered roughly 700 square miles and was the second largest protected area in the country. Given the laid-back vibe of the landscape outside the car windows, Josie didn't want to return in a rip-ship mood. Not after such a long absence. She steered the car through a picturesque village tucked into a valley. The name of this particular place escaped her, but no matter. Josie was doing her best to embrace not knowing everything about every village, town, city, and state to pepper a political speech to make the locals feel like they mattered. She couldn't see how anything would matter ever again. A charming tea shop on the corner caught her eye, and she parked in a spot that had just been freed up when a Mercedes pulled out with a vengeance and roared to life, fleeing the peacefulness of the main street in its tracks. It seemed everyone was heading in the opposite direction. The story of Josie's life, really. Sitting at a table in the corner, nursing a second cup of tea, Josie stared at her phone, determined not to check the news. The whole point of dashing to Britain after being scapegoated was to escape all campaign news. What was the point of following what would inevitably become one of the worst electoral routs of all time? If only Nora had read the words how Josie intended. She'd been clear. Say the words like an unrepentant male who'd been caught in a scandal. Not show weakness by grovelling and asking for Americans to forgive her. Josie had penned the words without an ounce of remorse. Nora had panicked in front of the cameras and gone off script. Josie could still picture the exact moment Nora had turned away from the teleprompter to speak from the heart. She'd done it many times before, but this was the one moment that Nora needed to do what she'd been told. The second before Nora opened her mouth to speak the words, "I'm so sorry I let you down," Josie knew it would go south. It wasn't solely the words. It was the way they were spoken. The shame etched into Nora's expression. Her quivering bottom lip. The shakiness of her voice. Everyone in the room knew right then and there it was all over. Nora Ackerman would never become President of the United States. Afterward, Nora pinned the blame on Josie. The speech Josie had written was brilliant, wasn't it? Josie sipped her tea. She'd poured her heart and soul into the words after her candidate had been caught flaunting her goodies by a reporter who had been embedded into the campaign to catch the billionaire Nora in everyday actions to humanize her to average American voters. The reporter had earned the trust of everyone on Nora's staff, even Josie. Josie had forgotten the one rule about reporters. They are never your friend. They adhered to the desire to hold all candidates accountable, regardless of party or common sense. The reporter in question torpedoed Nora's campaign over something so minor compared to other scandals simply because the reporter could, for her own personal gain. If Nora had been a man, it wouldn't have become such a big deal, which is why Josie had instructed Nora to talk like a man, unabashed, push back, to speak with righteousness on Nora's side. Be a fucking man. Josie shook a fist in the air, remembering that second before Nora tossed everything away. If only Josie could have nipped Nora's instinct with a firm shake of the head or something. Josie's phone sat on the tabletop, as if mocking her for being a scaredy cat for not looking. But Josie didn't want to give in. She wanted to stay strong. Her role in the campaign was over. She pressed a finger onto the table as if to reinforce that into her brain. Josie was no longer a part of the campaign. The last thing she needed was to check how bad it was going. Before Josie had boarded the plane, it looked more than bleak for Nora. Was it worse now? Part of Josie wished it was, if it made people realize Josie wasn't the reason for Nora's debacle. Nora was responsible for it all. She scooped the phone into her hand, pressed her finger to unlock the screen, and logged onto the New York Times app, only to be met with the headline, "Dead on Arrival." The Washington Post's headline screamed Nora shouldn't have ever been a candidate. "America deserves leaders, not fame-seeking harpies." That seemed somewhat harsh. All presidential candidates, no matter their background, were egomaniacs. That was the very nature of the office. No rational person would look at their reflection in the mirror and think, "I should be President of the United States." What rational person, though, tried to help a person reach the highest office in America? This was Josie's third and last attempt. What's going to become of me now? She stared at the dregs of tea at the bottom of her cup, trying to see her future, but only glimpsing the remnants of what might have been. She'd missed her shot at the ultimate posting for a speechwriter, and it stung more than she'd care to admit. Chapter 2. A stooped woman answered the door, her wrinkled face not giving Harriet much insight into the woman's inner thoughts. "Mrs. Cavell?" Harriet asked, unsure if she should have spoken louder.
"Yes."
The woman's voice was mostly clear, just a wisp of old lady to it. "I'm Harriet Powell. We spoke on the phone last week." Harriet chewed on a fleshy part of her inner cheek. "Do you remember?"
"Of course. I'm old, not stupid."
Harriet smiled awkwardly.
"You wanted to interview me. Why, I don't know."
The frail woman waved a hand in the air. Harriet was mesmerized by the woman's sharp blue eyes. Mrs. Cavell motioned for Harriet to step inside the cottage.
You live in Upper Chewford, two villages over?
Yes, that's right.
The woman looked Harriet up and down.
You're not from there.
It wasn't a question. She gestured for Harriet to take a seat in the living room. Harriet sat in an amethyst tartan wingback chair.
I recently moved to the area.
Are you one of those looking for a simpler life?
Not sure about simpler. At least it's not turning out that way.
Harriet dragged her hand through her hair. The woman lowered herself carefully onto the sofa.
Nothing in life ever does turn out the way you want it.
Harriet nodded.
True.
From our conversation, I gathered you're taking over the paper from Regis.
Yes, he's my uncle.
I never liked him.
Neither did Harriet, but she opted not to smear her uncle, who had given her the opportunity to turn around a fledgling local paper and to move into his cottage, which he hardly ever stayed in, when Harriet's life in London went tits up.
Would you like a cup of tea?
The woman seemed remiss she hadn't offered earlier.
Everyone says I make the best.
I'd love a cup. Can I help?
Harriet started to rise. Mrs. Cavell waved for Harriet to sit.
I can manage. You can snoop, or whatever you people do when unsupervised.
Harriet laughed. I'm not that type of journalist. Alone in the room, Harriet went over the notes she'd jotted down. Last week, she'd interviewed Mrs. Cavell's cousin, who, at the age of 16, had joined the armed citizen militia called the Home Guard during the final year of World War II. Mrs. Cavell returned with a teapot and cups on a tray. She poured two cups.
Jerry told me he talked your ear off.
That he did. Harriet accepted the tea.
Thank you. I've never understood why Jerry or anyone talks about the war as if they were the good old days.
Mrs. Cavell retook her seat, a cup and saucer on her lap. Harriet wasn't sure how to broach the start of the interview after that comment. As if Mrs. Cavell sensed this, she launched into it.
I was in Coventry with my mum. She had a job at one of the factories. It was an industrial city, which made it a target for the Germans to bomb. After the air raids in 1940, mum wanted to send me away, but I didn't want to leave her side. As it turned out, I survived. She didn't. The final raid occurred in 1942. Not many died during it, but...
Her voice trailed off in a forced, c'est la vie way. Harriet sipped the tea, agreeing it was one of the best, but didn't feel it was the right time to compliment Mrs. Cavell. Mrs. Cavell set her tea on a side table.
My father died in North Africa during the Second Battle of El Alamein. I believe that was...
She closed her eyes.
In October of 1942. The air raid was in August that year.
How old were you? Harriet asked in the softest tone she could.
8.
Mrs. Cavell briefly looked away.
It was so long ago, and yet... It feels like yesterday.
Harriet bobbed her head in understanding. She'd conducted many interviews over the years, and she instinctively knew when to stay silent, to let the subject set the tone and pace during emotional parts.
Mum always said I'd be an heartbreaker because of my blue eyes and dimple.
Mrs. Cavell placed a hand on her right cheek.
Were you?
The woman laughed quietly.
I may have broken one or two hearts in my day.
She rose and pulled a framed photo off the black Steinway piano in the corner, making the room seem so much smaller and cramped, but homier in an odd way.
This was taken when I was 17.
Harriet stared at the younger version of the strong-willed woman, her shoulders back, a seductive smile, and an expression that claimed she could take anything that came her way. Mrs. Cavell sat on the piano bench. Mum was so proud of my dimple. Back in 36, a woman in New York invented a dimple machine. Mum never tried it herself, but she probably would have, if given the opportunity. The contraption had knobs that pressed into the cheeks. Mrs. Cavell jabbed two fingers into her cheeks. It's odd to think people covet dimples when they're actually a deformity. She laughed, seeming lost in a memory. But you came here to hear how I survived losing my parents in the war. Yes, if you feel up to talking about it. It was all so long ago, she repeated. Harriet wasn't sure if this meant Mrs. Cavell wanted to speak about it or not. Mrs. Cavell sighed. I have no idea why it matters to people today. The world is so different now. Yes and no. People love to read origin stories, especially if someone overcame great obstacles to succeed, like you. You became a concert pianist who played all over the world. I was lucky. After Mum died, Jerry's family took me in. They had a piano, and after Thomas, Jerry's dad, heard me play once, he hunted high and low for a teacher. This was during the war. She laughed, suddenly looking much younger, but it faded quickly. I do believe playing the piano saved me. It gave me something to focus on for hours at a time. I think Thomas knew that deep down, which was why he paid for all the lessons. He lost his arm in the war. Everyone lost something, or someone. A silence overtook the room. Do you still play? Harriet asked. I do. Would you like to hear something? There was a sparkle in her eyes. It'd be an honour. After the interview concluded, Mrs. Cavell asked, Why don't you have a podcast? Harriet closed her notebook. Do you listen to them? Oh, yes. My grandson got me hooked on them. My eyes aren't what they used to be, and it's so much easier to listen. What's your favourite? Fortunately, with Fee and Jane. I haven't listened to that one. You should. They seem down to earth, like women I could be friends with. That's what I like about podcasts. It's easier to trust people when you hear their voices. You have a lovely voice. I'd listen to you. Is that right? Harriet took in a deep breath and slowly released it. I'm not sure I have the personality for it. Mrs. Cavell stared deeply into Harriet's eyes. You never know what you can handle until you have to. That's very wise advice. I'm at the age where everyone thinks whatever I say is wise. It comes with the white hair and wrinkles. Her grin conveyed a secret reservoir of knowledge. I may look into podcasting then. If you do, I'd love to be one of your first interviews. You have my word. I'll hold you to it. I may be old, but I don't forget promises. Harriet believed her. They said their goodbyes, and Mrs. Cavell shut the door. Harriet climbed into her car, but before she inserted the key, she took out her iPhone and downloaded an episode of Fortunately with Fee and Jane. She hit play. Chapter 3. A few hours after Josie satiated her appetite and took a walk in the countryside to kill time and centre her chi, a new obsession as of this morning, now that she could think of things like that, Josie had decided she couldn't delay any more. It was time to reach her destination. Her family had no idea she was even in the UK, since Josie had hopped on the first flight she could catch to flee America. Josie abandoned the rental in the parking spot behind the church she'd attended occasionally during her childhood. The yellow stone spire piercing the deep blue sky. Inhaling the crisp air, Josie stretched her arms overhead, bending to the right and then left. Now, according to her iPhone, it was several ticks past 10 in the morning, and Josie stood next to the Ale River, a little waterway that carved its way through the centre of Upper Chewford, bringing a smile to her lips. On her right were butter-coloured houses constructed with the distinctive Cotswold stone, each one with a unique garden, making it clear the neighbours were competing with everyone else by adding what they considered that special touch to garner more attention and, in all probability, an increase in photos posted on social media. Josie preferred the lot with a wooden doghouse that had a white, curly-haired dog snoozing inside with his head resting on his front paws. She peered in to see if the dog was real. One of the ears twitched. Josie scanned the green fields to the left of the river. Why would anyone want to leave this place? All the maniac drivers she'd passed didn't know how good they had it here. Only sociopaths would dash toward the craziness of city life. However, Josie had never actually lived here, and her visits had been few and far between since becoming an adult 2 decades ago. Now, as Josie stood in her mum's village, she was unable to banish the thought that she had failed. Maybe coming here was a mistake. What did Josie think she'd find in the Cotswolds? Her eyes landed on the Golden Fleece, Josie's ultimate destination. The pub was mere steps from the river. All she had to do was cross the river and then announce to her mum something. Come on, Josie. Words are your thing. Spin this disaster into something other than a catastrophe. Her eyes fell to the water once again. Did it really classify as a river? It was only thigh deep and about 30 feet wide. It had several stone footbridges crossing it, but Josie determined, if need be, she could ford the river without too much trouble. She chastised herself once again. Why did it matter if Ale could actually be classified as a full-fledged flowing watercourse or not? Stop being so American, and stop stalling the inevitable. Josie's gaze took in everything again. This place was the definition of charming. It was as if Josie had stepped into a painting depicting the perfect old-fashioned English countryside village that had stopped in time when everyone and everything moved at a reasonable speed. Before the destructive 24-hour news cycles, the internet, social media, all the components that had recently brought everything crashing down in Josie's life, forcing her to retreat from the career she'd painstakingly built since high school when she first volunteered for a political campaign for the not-so-famous Upper Chewford, to lick her wounds and decide what was in store for her next phase. Yes, that was the right track. A new beginning. Because there was no going back to speech writing, not after everyone in the business basically witnessed her firing, when Nora had reamed her in front of a reporter's camera. The same off-air reporter who had filmed Nora, investigating everyone's downfall. Josie shut her eyes, not wanting to give everything too much thought, fearful she'd break out into full-on panic mode. Now or never, Josie, she said as a way to bully her nerve. Making her way across the footbridges, Josie headed for the entrance of the pub. Although she wasn't particularly tall, a hair under 5 feet 6 inches, Josie still ducked her head when walking through the door. It was much darker inside, even with sunlight streaming through the 9-paned windows, Josie released the hand.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?